If you're curious to engage with a lot of the topics we explore on the podcast in more creative and embodied ways, we welcome you to join us in Alchemize, our 10-week audio-based program of daily imagination practices intended to disrupt status quo ways of thinking, sensing, relating, and being. To be honest, without any grant support for our show right now, and we did just get turned down by several mainstream environmentalism philanthropies, this program and our Patreon are our primary means of supporting our labor for these free podcasts right now. We really want to remain untethered to corporate interests, and every small contribution to our Patreon or enrollment in our program Alchemize helps to ensure that we can continue producing these vital conversations that feature voices and perspectives often sidelined from mainstream media. So if you value our work and want to dive deeper with us, join us in Alchemize today at greendreamer.com/alchemize and join our Patreon starting at just $3 at patreon.com/greendreamer. Thank you so, so much for however you are able to support our work during these critical times. We are so deeply grateful.
One of the more important things for me to think about was, how are these people trying to live well? Like, what are the strategies that they're putting into place? Not necessarily to have power over other folks, but to distribute the power relations in the community so that everybody is working towards what they call dignified livelihoods while they're still in resistance. And that is incredibly important.
You're listening to Green Dreamer, and I'm your host, Kamea Shane. Today, we are speaking with Lindsay Naylor, who uses climate change, food, and agricultural production as a lens to explore human-environment interactions and geopolitical conditions of development. As a feminist political geographer, she's primarily interested in investigating the multi-sided geo of geopolitics and examining how it is written unevenly across space, place, and bodies. Her book, which we will draw upon today and explore with, is Fair Trade Rebels: Coffee Production and Struggles for Autonomy in Chiapas.
It's one of the things that I puzzled about quite a bit is that, and I've written about this elsewhere, is that in order for fair trade certification to exist, there has to be someone in poverty. There always already has to be someone who is at a disadvantage in order to provide them with an opportunity to meet standards for certification that are largely set by folks who are on the consumer end, who want to live out this conscientious consumerism, to make ethical decisions in the marketplace. And all of that is sort of put on the producer to enact so that they can be paid a price that is still not very generous. And that really just allows them to, what I say, is stand in place. So yeah, it prevents folks from falling into the deepest pits of poverty, but it does not allow for a standard of living that is perhaps what is being imagined by the people who are buying these goods when they are looking for the label and thinking that they're making these ethical decisions.
Yeah, that's really important to note. And your book, Fair Trade Rebels, goes deeper into all of these things and really shifts the focus from the abstract concept of fair trade and whether it is quote unquote working to the perspectives of small farmers, particularly in Chiapas, Mexico. I'm aware that you've had to sit with what you had initially perceived as a contradiction of the self-declared autonomous communities in this region, perhaps tethering themselves to the global market through fair trade. So I'd be curious to hear you expand on your initial curiosities and ultimately how you came to see their engagement with fair trade actually as intentional strategies of their resistance.
Yeah, thank you. So the inquiry that brought me into the research that I ended up doing for this book was, how is a movement, a social movement that is largely critical of capitalism, of free trade, using a marketplace that is global in its character to essentially keep the, not the movement itself, but to keep the people who populate the movement afloat. And I got to Chiapas, Mexico, which is, again, it's the southernmost state in Mexico. It has a majority indigenous population, indigenous Maya population of Tzotziles and Tzotziles primarily, although there are multiple Mayan language groups that make up the population. But there are a number of coffee cooperatives, and there's a longer history that I get into about the support for coffee by the state of Mexico and things of that character. But what was interesting was talking with folks who are very anti-government, are very anti the North American Free Trade Agreement, as it's known as NAFTA, that had been passed in the mid-90s, but are very much relying on these global connections to create an opportunity for cash income, to create an opportunity for relationships to be built across state lines, and to really mobilize storytelling about what is happening in Chiapas State, which would otherwise perhaps not make it to, oh, I don't know, a marketplace or a coffee shop in the United States or in Western Europe or in Japan. And so there are a few events that precipitated this particular group's participation. And I won't talk about them in great depth, but it's important to know that the coffee cooperatives that I worked with and that are largely responsible for connecting these social movements up into these networks that allow their stories to be told were created out of intense struggle and violence. And so, and I keep up with folks in Chiapas, and that violence is ongoing, and it has been for years. And when I say years, I want folks to understand that there is an intensity of violence that is happening in Chiapas State that has been intensified since the mid-90s, but that this is something that's characterized by the folks who participate in these struggles as the War of 500 Years, which ties back to colonization and conquest and the erasure and invisibilization and the genocide of indigenous peoples in the Americas. And all of that is threaded through the struggle that exists today that maybe you don't think about when you're drinking coffee, particularly if it's, you know, not coming from Southern Mexico, but fair trade certification and direct trade or more ethical trade in coffee really comes out of solidarity organizing in the Americas, between the Americas and Europe, or the Americas and as a whole. And to go to Chiapas and to talk to folks about why they're participating in these markets isn't really to talk about coffee. It isn't really to talk about the cash income that they received. It's really to talk about how they are building livelihoods that are different and how they are able to maintain their identity as subsistence producers, as indigenous people. And they're able to resist the efforts of the government to remove them from the land. And there's a lot going on there, but the important things to pull out for me as part of this work was that it wasn't really a contradictory thing that was happening. It was a strategy, as you mentioned, where it was just one ingredient in a larger recipe for how to maintain a struggle where the state is trying to take away access to communal land and to privatize it, meaning that what was once the farming area of a large group of people to take it and carve it up into pieces and assign title to individual families, or in particular, heads of households, and in this case, heads of households who were men, and to fight that. It is an effort to maintain their existence as subsistence farmers. So to cultivate corn, to cultivate the milpa, which is the three sisters, which is corn, beans, and squash. And if anybody's interested in why that's a really super sustainable way of farming, I'm happy to dig into that a little bit more because it is, and it's incredible, and it's been in use for thousands of years, but it is an important part of the identity of these folks is to cultivate corn that allows them to not have to buy it in the marketplace, something that's become increasingly more difficult, especially with the introduction of free trade agreements with the United States, which outcompetes Mexico in corn production in terms of economies of scale or the cost of production. And then really just being able to be in solidarity and to uphold these movements that have declared autonomy from the state and to support their communities with their own forms of education, with their own health clinics, with their own agricultural extension, as we would maybe talk about it in the United States context, and to really do for themselves what hadn't been being done by the government, which had largely ignored these folks for decades and really were trying to make them go away effectively. The indigenous folks in Mexico are considered a problem by the state, and that's a huge violence. And so they were very under-resourced communities. And one of the only reasons why they have access to these marketplaces now, and I'll kind of wind down my answer here, because there's a lot of history there and I'm trying really hard not to dig too deeply into it, but is because of the rebellion that happened in 1994 and the need for the government to have access to these communities that did not have direct highways or roads or established connections between towns because they're in the highlands, which happens to be a very good place to grow coffee, but not a place that the government was particularly interested in investing in with roads or infrastructure or schools or clinics and things of that character. And so really sort of digging in and figuring out what the operationalizing of fair trade is, that it's just another piece of the puzzle. It's not how these people identify.
Yeah, thank you. There's obviously a lot more historical context that is important to dig into, and we really appreciate the overview that you've shared with us here. And I think that when the concept of sovereignty comes up, whether food sovereignty, indigenous sovereignty, community sovereignty, and so forth, it can come with implications of a place being totally self-sufficient with self-defined more communally. And it also can be romanticized too, especially after engaging with the communities of Chiapas in their active resistance and work to maintain their sovereignty. I'd be interested in you in having you share more about these visions of sovereignty, as well as perhaps the messier like practice of both and, like reclaiming power and autonomy while still engaging the broader webs of power relations that they're ultimately still situated in the tapestry of. Because I sense that these are critical questions and challenges for a lot of communities seeking to reclaim power from wherever they are today. Like, what if a purist exit doesn't exist? What does the work of rebuilding power mean for communities whose lifeways have become so deeply entangled with larger extractive systems that they can't just neatly extricate themselves, but sort of have to play some of the games and strategize with some of its rules in mind? And I know there are many running threads here, but I welcome you to take this in whatever direction calls to you at this moment.
I love this question so much because as I am a political geographer, so I'm very interested in how power is distributed over space and place and between people and things of that character. And what is really fundamentally important to understand about the situation in Chiapas is that these are not homogenous communities of folks. So it's not as if you have a town or a community or a village that said, okay, we're going to draw a boundary around ourselves and declare ourselves autonomous from the government. And we're going to try to democratize the food system through things like declaring food sovereignty and trying to isolate and be self-sufficient. That just doesn't exist. And for a number of reasons. One, the indigenous folks that are participating in these movements are not all interested in the autonomy movement. And in fact, there are some who are very supportive of the current government, whether it be the state government or the federal government, and they all live in the same place. So there are ways of identifying who is participating in autonomy, which I won't talk about just for their protection, but it is clear that there are differences within communities and there is there are power dynamics that are happening at that very small scale, even down to the scale of the household, where there might be members of a household who are participating in the struggle and others who have decided that that's not for them, right? And that scales up all the way to global networks. The idea of self-sufficiency, I also would say, is largely a myth at this point in our contemporary era, in that the way that power is distributed, the way that resources are distributed, and corporate capitalist interests, and this isn't unique to Chiapas or to Mexico, really make it difficult to be self-sufficient, entirely self-sufficient. And even the folks that I worked with while I was there in trying to stay out of the market for corn, they were still having to buy corn by the end of the year. And this is something that, you know, colleagues of mine who do work in Mexico, but or in Central America, Christopher Bacon, for example, have talked about as being the lean months. And these are the months where after the corn that has been stored, and it can be stored in a number of ways in terms of how it's processed. But once that runs out and how decisions are made about spending cash income, because especially for folks that are participating in commodity markets, like selling coffee, whether it's certified or not, that might be the only cash income that they bring in for the entire year. And at best, depending on the price of coffee, depending on the size of their plot, it's not very much money. And in fact, some of the folks that I talked to, you know, that were making the most were making about $1,000 a year. So choices about how to spend that cash income become really important in between harvests, especially in terms of not just buying food, but sending kids to school, transportation between areas in order to gain access to resources, because there's not necessarily like a market or somewhere to buy these food supplies nearby. And then also things like health concerns. Like, does someone need glasses? Is there someone who's diabetic in the family? Is there an event in which someone needs medical care? And those all of those things cost money. And so there are important negotiations that happen there. And that's why I talk very much about how there are multiple strategies that are ongoing. And that's, again, not something that is specific to this place. I think how it's being mobilized in this place is what makes it so fascinating. But peasant strategies worldwide are to be diverse, are to have multiple ways of accessing resources, growing food, gaining access to cash income. But I would say that they're fairly limited in Chiapas, and intentionally so, which is, again, part of that power struggle. There are, you know, there's a very strong military presence. There are efforts by the state to continue to destabilize the struggles. And then not having, again, that homogenous population means that there's not really an ability to just say, okay, well, we exist in a bubble now, and we support each other through our collective work, and we're going to grow corn, we're going to grow beans, and we're going to grow squash, and we're going to live happily ever after. Yeah, it doesn't function that way. And in fact, one other just tidbit that's important to note is that I talked about some of the violence that, well, I talked about the fact that there was violence that created, that required the creation of these cooperatives. And one of those moments is a splitting off of groups that are participating in, or people that were growing coffee, participating in the struggle, leaving a cooperative because other members of that cooperative perpetuated a massacre against their group. So, like, and they're living in the same communities. And there is not that kind of mobility to leave the land because of the way that communal land structures and the way that title to land or how land is distributed works. And so it's this very messy sort of situation. So there is no purist exit, as you asked me to speak. I mean, I didn't mean to suggest that you think that there was one, but there isn't. Yeah. For sure. And so, you know, I think that one of the more important things for me to think about was, how are these people trying to live well? Like, what are the strategies that they're putting into place? Not necessarily to have power over other folks, but to distribute the power relations in the community so that everybody is working towards what they call dignified livelihoods while they're still in resistance. And that is incredibly important.
You're listening to Green Dreamer, an alternative podcast made possible by listeners like you. To support our community-powered show and listen to our disruption-free, extended, and bonus episodes, join us today on Patreon at patreon.com/greendreamer. Yeah, it is. Everything is messy. It's messy within communities, and also every community across the globe defines sovereignty differently, and they have different relations and forms of reliances on their broader system. So yeah, this ultimately just really emphasizes the importance of, as you shared, the why of where and really centering place-specific dynamics. And there's also been a growing movement of regenerative agriculture alongside of fair trade. I'm thinking of various clothing brands, for example, that might work with fair trade farmers and even farmer cooperatives in India to source their cotton, which are grown in ways that regenerate the health of their lands. And that is wonderful. And many of these cooperatives, or so we're told at least, get paid a quote unquote premium. But the reason that I have personally questioned this soil-centered way of defining regenerative is because it doesn't really do anything to address the uneven exchange of the global context, which is this reality that 1 hour's economic worth of the labor for someone in the global north might be quote unquote worth 20, 30 or more hours of labor of another person in the global south because of the suppressed wages there. And so with this neo-colonial system in place, consumers, even when they are paying for fair trade or regenerative products produced in the global south, as good as their intentions might be, it still unavoidably upholds that same extractive dynamic of ultimately still sucking resources and products of labor disproportionately out of global south communities. And Max Isle was our past guest, and he mentioned that people in the US have access to more of the things produced in the whole world than people in the south because of this uneven accumulation going on. And this isn't to place blame or to say that it is on any individual consumer to rewire the global economy, but it does make me question, like, how can we consider this monodirectional trend as regenerative or as fair in the whole socio-ecological, economic, cultural sense of the word? And if we are selective about what they define, then it does kind of echo your question of who is fair trade for and who is regenerative for. So with all of these things in mind, I'm interested in whatever else you want to add to these questions, and also having you expand on the nuanced concept of what it means to be in solidarity.
I mean, yes to all, right? I teach a whole semester on uneven development and on the ways in which colonial imperial relations that many people probably think are past because independence has been achieved. And you know, if you look at the global map of independence, some of that has been during my lifetime, but the power relations still exist, and they're absolutely extractive and exploitative. And one of the things that I often suggest, because there is, like, we want to be doing better, many of us, and even I think the folks that might be doing harm are still thinking that this is a good thing for reason X, Y, or Z. But regenerative agriculture, yes, great. Sustainable practices, farming practices, awesome. Recycling, like, all of this sounds good. And why wouldn't we want to support that, right? Especially if we can do it so easily as consumers by just looking for a different stamp on the thing that we're already going to buy. But I am skeptical that there is any way that we are going to buy our way to a better planet, to better human and non-human relations. And again, this gets back to the point I made earlier, in that in order for some of these certifications to exist, somebody has to be in poverty. Someone has to be being exploited. And that's not a way to fix exploitation. You know, capitalism, which is the economic system that we sort of predominantly put our understanding of how the economy works in, and maybe I can word that a little bit differently, but it's kind of the only thing we think about, maybe when we think about the economy, exists for profit and not for people necessarily. And there's a group of folks that benefit from that more than others. And so there is this accumulation that happens in the global core, which are these former colonizing or settler colonial states, where a lot of consumption is able to happen because of differences in wages, but not exclusively, right? And this is why I really like the concept of scale. Not everybody in the global periphery is doing poorly, and not everybody in the global core is doing well. And so, yes, in the United States, we have a lot of consumer mobility. I am privileged enough that when I want to buy coffee, which the only place that coffee is grown in the United States is in Hawaii, which may as well be considered a colony of the United States, but it's in that tropical band where coffee is grown. So we have to largely get our coffee from outside of the United States. I am privileged enough, though, to be able to buy coffee from a coffee roaster that buys directly from one of the coffee cooperatives I worked with. But not everybody can do that. Sometimes in my classes, when my students are talking about this these notions of ethical consumption, they want to know what to do, right? Because we don't want to hear that all of these measures that are supposed to be doing things better, they're supposed to be righting wrongs, are in fact just perpetuating these bad systems. And there's a lot of what do I do? What should I buy? And I can't tell my student, well, you should buy from this coffee cooperative that's struggling, right? Because that's a privilege that I have and a choice that I make about how I'm interacting with the marketplace. And so instead, one of the things that I think that as consumers we need to think about, and that can be on any number of levels, but particularly consumers with more financial mobility, the folks that think that buying an $80 t-shirt because it's made with fair trade certified cotton are doing something really phenomenal with their money, is to find out more about it. Because if we have the privilege to spend that kind of money, we have the privilege to make time to understand what's happening in these systems and to think about what these labels mean, what they are, how they're different from one another, because they're not all the same, whether they're making similar claims. And to really do what I call looking behind the label, to find out what are these practices, because it's very common that when we buy something, we don't think about the conditions in which it was produced. And I talk a lot about this, right? Like if we're going to buy a diamond engagement ring as part of, you know, that particular romantic heterosexual normative story that's told about getting married in Western culture, we're not maybe thinking about a pit mine in a sub-Saharan African country that may or may not be deploying child labor. When we put lettuce into a salad, we're not thinking about the valley in California and the labor that was mobilized possibly at very early hours of the morning and then forced to wait for dew to break or for the sun to rise and then to get paid per head of lettuce. Like we don't think about what happens in other parts of the commodity chain. We also don't think about where it goes afterwards, right? And that makes it really easy for us to buy into some of this stuff, which again, like who doesn't want to think that they are purchasing their way to a better world? But it is still based on this premise of moving profit forward, moving extraction forward, and just keeping this system going. And I think I make a fairly strong argument in my work that this isn't the only system and that we can participate in others. And there are already existing systems that are doing things differently. And if we start to widen our way of looking at how we participate in economic exchanges, that maybe we can start to think about what that can look like differently. But I feel like I got pretty far away from regenerative agriculture and clothing and cotton, but I think that really the narratives that undergird these things are important. And It's kind of a joke that I make in my family when I first started studying food agriculture systems. Like, yeah, okay, those Pop-Tarts are organic, but that doesn't mean that they're like good for you, like they're healthy, right? It means that the wheat was produced with different systems. And I think that's just important to remember.
Yeah, thank you for all of these threads that you brought in. And definitely, I feel like how a lot of people come to see the ways that they are tethered to these stories of injustices might be through consumerism. So it is very understandable that people might begin their journeys through asking questions like, how do I buy better as a consumer? But then, as you shared, it's also important for people who have the ability to pay premium to buy better to also dig deeper to see the limitations of playing within these systems and to dream beyond and know that we can and also need to unwire and rewire the fundamental extractive logics that undergird them altogether. And the final topic I would love to weave into this conversation is the concept of green gentrification, where you share about how greening initiatives in urban spaces are starting to have a gentrifying effect. So how would you begin illustrating this picture in terms of what you've seen play out? And what would you like to share in regards to this mismatch between greening endeavors and the communities that they seek to support?
Yeah, again, this is one of those things where you see something like an urban garden and you cheer, right? Here's small scale food production. Maybe it's being done by folks who didn't have great access to fresh fruits and vegetables before. But the best way I can describe green gentrification does not come from my own research, but otherwise from a colleague and friend of mine, Ali Alkin, who's at the University of Pacific. And I remember Dr. Alkin relating in a presentation given at an annual meeting, this new $1 million per condo development or something. I might be getting the number wrong, but it was a high price point for these condos. And they were using a cooperative urban farm called Fat Beets, P-H-A-T, Beets, as one of the amenities of this condo without consulting this group. And so using something that started out as an urban project to benefit Oakland, which, you know, until recently was not necessarily viewed as an up and coming place to live, was part of this gentrifying process. Like, look, there's green things here. Now we'll probably plow it over for something that is going to be a better development project, but we're going to list it as an amenity because it looks cool and is attractive to young professionals potentially. And I saw that play out in my own experience, but differently, in that there was a plot of land in Eugene, Oregon, where I did my PhD, that was turned into a garden that was staffed by students at the university. And as soon as that plot of land started to look good, it instantly was purchased and is now a credit union. And it's next to a big fancy rebuild of the courthouse that's there. And so there are these sorts of dynamics that happen where we look at a site and we see under-resourced areas, plots that don't have any buildings on them that are growing weeds, houses that don't have either upkeep or investment by the owners or the tenants. And people start to use those spaces, and they start to use them in really creative ways, ways that benefit the folks around them, that create these urban green spaces, which we know are good for combating urban heat island effects. And then as soon as these places become attractive to folks, other sorts of things start to move in to price out people. And so there's this, yes, this thing is good and we should do it, but how do we protect it? Or how do we make it a, for lack of a better word, normal part of this place without having it become overrun by all of these other things that are then unaffordable?
Yeah, that's a really powerful consideration. Like, let's say if a community historically has been very polluted by I don't know, like toxic waste or manufacturing facilities that have moved out, and people within the communities are taking matters into their own hands and cleaning it up and really greening the space, it then makes it a lot more quote unquote nice. And then it becomes more attractive for other people to now move in there now that it is quote unquote more nice. And then it might actually push out the people that made that place what it was to begin with. Is that sort of like the challenge at play here?
Yeah, it absolutely is. And it happens in different ways too, because there are greening initiatives that are happening as part of citywide, because I think at the city scale, that's where we're seeing the most movement on climate change adaptation, at least in the United States, I should say, although there are some studies in Europe, but I'm not familiar enough with them to name them. But there's a lot of push from mayors to create these urban green spaces. And it is a good thing. And there is evidence to suggest that where we are lacking green spaces in cities in the United States is in places of lower income tenancy. And so like bringing more green space to these places is a desirable thing. But the way that land development works suggests that it's temporary. And so there are different initiatives across the country to try to counter that and hold green space in reserve for a common good. And there are things like land trusts, and there are different like edible projects. Like I worked with the Philadelphia Orchard Project, which is creating spaces of freely available fruits, trees, or fruits, you're not eating the trees, fruits and nuts through tree planting. There are a lot of initiatives out on the West Coast. Like there's one in Seattle. There's the Fallen Fruit Project out of LA. Oh, there's the Boston Tree Party up in Massachusetts. You know, and there are these groups that are coming together and saying, no, we're gonna protect this space. And so, no, you can't plow over these trees. And trees are actually a much more effective way of laying claim to land because they're not annuals. So if you're planting a vegetable garden, most of us may be aware that, you know, you plant a tomato plant and then it has one season and then you have to plant another one. They don't regenerate in the next year. Generally speaking, they do not. But, you know, trees last for years. So those initiatives have been better, I would say, at securing urban space, but they still are attractive sites. So there it's multiple. And again, we've talked about things being messy. Like nothing that I look into is simple.
Right.
So there's more that needs to happen besides that. Right. Mm. And the great difficulty is that the people who will benefit the most from this in general don't have the capacity or shouldn't be asked to do the work, mm-hmm. right? We have so many people who are in groups that have been marginalized that are basically tasked with doing this work that really should be done by the people who are not and the people who have the power. And that instead it's the people who have the power who are pushing them out while they're trying to get the work done. And it is a exhausting process. And again, I don't want to be negative about these things because there's so much good work being done, but there's so much more that could be done to make it so that it's not exhausting. And that work needs to be collective.
Yeah. Oof.
I know. I'm a killjoy. Like,
yeah. No, it's important though. I mean, just across our various themes today, from fair trade to regenerative to greening endeavors, as you named as well, there's this underlying thread of how many well-intentioned initiatives have ended up reinforcing the same extractive dynamics of injustice that they might, at least at the surface, aim to address. And this can feel very discouraging, but I also just really see this as a realization of our need to keep digging deeper and not take things at face value, and instead to center the gauge of power and to center the voices of frontline communities. And also, as Dr. Bayo Akomolafe suggests, to kind of embrace hopelessness as a way to not be led back on the same highways over and over again. So with all this said, as we close off here, what more would you like to share on anything we discussed today or anything else on your mind or on where you see our cracks and openings? And what are your calls to action or a deeper inquiry for our listeners?
Yes, actually, I mean, you can't tell, but I'm nodding my head vigorously. And I appreciate the sort of the hopeful undertone there, right? And that is the message that I think is really important, is that especially right now, you know, I say that there has been an ongoing apocalypse for a lot of groups, but this is a particularly tense moment, I think, in where we sit in early 2024, trying to decide what is happening in the world. And so maintaining that hope, that possibility, I think is really important. And being willing to understand that change has to happen at all scales, right? I have a good friend who was like, should I not be drinking almond milk because there's a drought in California? And I said, do you think that that's going to solve the problem? You know, but it is a conscious choice. And it's a educated rationale for thinking about, well, what is the plant-based milk that I want to have in my home and why? And that's something that happens at the individual scale. But then there are things that can happen at the household scale, like decisions to just purchase differently or compost or do a, you know, like a time banking thing based on your availability. You know, maybe you're really excellent at sewing and someone's really excellent at making shelves and you can trade each other kind of thing. There's lots of different ways, depending on our own resources, that we can participate on an individual and household level. But there are also things that we need to do at other scales. And again, this is where the work has to be collective. And it can't just come from the communities that are being the most negatively impacted. And so how can we create community coalitions? How can we go to our city councils, our state legislatures? And again, I'm largely talking from a US context, but there are these multi-scalar, you know, situations elsewhere. But how can we start to level up? Because ultimately, it has to happen at all levels. And this is, again, where I think it's really important to not think that there's a single solution, a silver bullet, or a universal that is going to solve the problems that we see and that we want very much to solve. And so it's really thinking about, what are the multiple ways in which we can engage? What are the small everyday things we can do? What are the medium-term things that we can work on collectively? And what are the long-term, you know, major things that have to be really well-resourced in order to get the work done? And think about what that means and where, if we are in a position of power or privilege or are well-resourced, we can not necessarily be a voice or be an influence, but be or present at least as an ally or an advocate, and then learn from that experience. There's also, I think, a process of unlearning that has to happen. We are existing in a society where I ask my students, what are you going to do when you graduate from college? And they kind of look around the room like I'm asking a stupid question, because obviously the answer is to get a job so that you can pay bills. And I want to kind of throw that out there as a, really? Is that our only sort of purpose of existing? And is that the only reason why we come to the table to learn from each other, whether it's in a university setting or elsewhere? There's a lot of different ways to learn. And I think we just have a really wonderful opportunity that maybe we're not taking, and we could do better with that.
Well, Green Dreamer, we are coming to a close here, but we will have more references and resources from this episode linked in our show notes at greendreamer.com. And for now, Lindsay, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. I really enjoyed our conversation. And yeah, just grateful for all you've shared with us here. For now, what final words of wisdom do you have for us as Green Dreamers?
Well, I will just say thank you so much for the invitation to have this conversation. I don't usually get to talk about power this much, but I will say, think about, in the way that we're approaching things, who benefits from this? Like, if you're not thinking about power, think about who benefits, and then just take care of yourselves.
If you enjoyed this conversation and would like to dive deeper through our extended episode, which also includes some of our guests' personal inspirations and more in-depth explorations of these same topics, join us on Patreon today at patreon.com/greendreamer. As a patron, you will receive a unique personal podcast link so that you can listen to our extended conversations, occasional behind-the-scenes episodes, and also other bonuses, all conveniently using the same app that you already use to listen to this version of the show. As an alternative media endeavor, we rely on the direct support of our friends and community. So thank you so much for becoming a patron, contributing a gift of any amount, or helping to share out your favorite episodes. Green Dreamer's audio editor is Scott Donnell. Our researcher and editor is Anissa Simahali, and I'm your host and producer, Kamea Shane. Thank you so much again, and we'll catch you soon in the next episode.